minutes. It's, yeah.
You know, like 1 minute, but
you know,
like,
God,
we know,
the
construction
stuff. Oh,
really? Yeah, not so much
residential. Wow. Well, it has to be just, yeah, it should just fall in whatever. Who knows, we're in the ocean or no, yeah. It's crazy. Okay, so we are in the middle of a topic, and today I think we'll conclude. We were doing the topic of the Arim Miklat, which seemingly is like a, you know, something which is actually not so relevant to us as we, because we don't have Arim Miklat now, these cities of refuge. But as we saw, and we will see more today, everything in Torah is very relevant, and everything has an incredible lesson. And not only is it relevant, and as in, like, it's so applicable and so, it's actually amazing how it affects even our day-to-day life, even, so to speak, these mitzvahs that we can't practically do now. So as we said, there were six specific cities of refuge set aside within Eretz Yisrael proper. Actually, three in Eretz Yisrael proper and three across the Jordan and those 2.5 tribes. There will be another three added when Mashiach will come. These six cities of refuge are also part of what we call in a general category, the cities of the Levium. The Levium have an additional 42 cities. So altogether, this 42 plus 6 is 48 cities, which are designated for the Levium. And all of the cities of the Levium really provide refuge. And as we mentioned, what's the refuge? The refuge is mainly for somebody who killed inadvertently. They run to the city and they are protected from any family who wants to take revenge. Because in Torah, interestingly enough, there is an allowance given where if a family member has been killed, you as a family member are permitted, it's an interesting thing because we have this thing about not taking revenge, and yet because there is a murder that happened, if the person is not in the city of refuge, it is considered that they are liable, so to speak, for the death penalty, and therefore you are permitted to kill them. So in other words, the fascinating thing is that the city of refuge, it's an amazing thing. It actually changes almost the status of the person that finds themselves within that city to being one who is protected and not liable for the death penalty. And if he leaves the city, he becomes liable. There's an interesting thing that even people who killed intentionally also run to the city of refuge, and they are provided protection until the court case. Once they've been, you know, the judge has decided that they have killed intentionally and that they've committed murder, well, then they'll be put to death by the Beis Din. So that will be taken care of. But for those who, as we say, have killed inadvertently, and that's what the judge decided, or that's, you know, obvious that that's what happens, they remain in that city of refuge, protected, until, as we said, the Kohen Gadol dies. When the Kohen Gadol dies, then they're permitted to leave the city. And the fascinating thing is, it's like such an interesting thing because we think about revenge. Revenge is an emotional thing. So what changes all of a sudden because the Kohen Gadol died and now you're not worried that the family member will take revenge? It's such a strange kind of thing if you think about it. And we're going to see something very beautiful in the Habar Benel, how he explains why that works, so to speak. But what we can see is that definitely the status of the person changes, whereas as soon as the Kohen Gadol dies, he is not considered a murderer at all, not inadvertent, not any kind of murderer. He's just like every other citizen, offered the full protection of the law. So he's totally safe, leaves the city, goes back to where he came from, and continues his life as he did before. What that means is that there is no time period given. The person doesn't know how long he's going to remain in that city of refuge. The Kohen Gadol can live 20 years, can live a month, you don't know. And that's what's fascinating, is that every person has a different trajectory of what happens to him after he's committed perhaps the same exact crime as some, or whatever, the same, if you want to call it crime, but the same mistake that somebody else made. You see something fascinating from that in itself, that we really truly believe Hashem runs the world, obviously. And even though Hashem gives us the concept of judgment and deciding, and there are certain things that man has to take care of, nevertheless, a lot of things God takes care of. And here's one of them where the person's actual time sentence is all up to Hashem. And we say something very interesting. The Meshech Chochma says a fascinating thing. He says, perhaps we can see from here that when a person commits an offense, and he, you know, he does this type of inadvertent murder, and he's there in this city of refuge, and then the Kohen Gadol is going to pass away at a certain time, it could even be that the fate of the Kohen Gadol is dependent on the person. Because if the person did, you know, there's different degrees of negligence, as we know in life, that we can have. If the person's negligence was very slight, like, in other words, it really shouldn't have happened, and it happened, you know, it was so, like, so wild that it actually the other person died, well, perhaps he's only going to be have to be in the city for a very short time. Whereas if the person was negligent, okay, it was negligence, but still was negligent in a way which perhaps he could have avoided, then Hashem will make sure that he is there for a longer time, which means that the Kohen Gadol will live longer, which is quite amazing how one, the domino effect almost, in a sense where, it's not domino effect, but everything is connected to each other in this world, and everything affects each other. And it's a fascinating thing. But we say in Torah, no person suffers because of somebody else. So each person has their own trajectory, but Hashem somehow makes it all work together to coordinate the timing. Okay, but putting that aside, let's go. I want to show you something on your in your booklet. Okay, so in your booklet you have first, I see, okay, the Abarbanel. Yeah, okay, so let's do that first. I'll come back to this after this. Okay, so it's a bit long, but we're not going to do it all inside, but we'll follow a little bit inside, and I'll show you something really beautiful. Let me just see, put this away. Okay, so this is, what you have is what's known as the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel his name was Don Yitzchak Abarbanel. He lived actually during the time of the Spanish I don't know if you call it the Inquisition as much as it was the Inquisition, but it was the time when the Jews were actually banished from Spain, so like 1490s. He was a very prominent member of the royal court. He was an advisor to the king. This is what's crazy, that in Spain, even at that time when the Jews were banished, they had high positions. A very wealthy man, a scientist, very respected, and yet the Jews were still banished from Spain. And it's told that the historical information that we have is that the King Ferdinand actually told him that he can stay. He can stay in Spain. He's not being kicked out. But he himself refused because the Jews were banished. And he said, no, that doesn't work that way with me. And he left with them. It's fascinating. But he wrote a commentary on Chumash and on the prophets, on the Nevi'im. Very, very, very rational, very quite lengthy, quite detailed, and really putting things to understand how things fit in the Torah, both the order and the way things fit grammatically and the way things fit logically and rationally, to help us understand. So he discusses this whole last chapter, chapter 35, which is the last chapter of Chumash Bamidbar. And as we saw in this chapter, there were a few topics, and he ties them all together and shows us the flow of these psukim. And we'll see how it connects specifically to our topic we'll get to. And we said a little bit of it at one point, but I just want to do a little bit more in length because it's so beautiful. Because as we mentioned, I know a lot of times we repeated this, but this is the end of Moshe Rabbeinu's life, because Moshe doesn't go into the land of Israel. Here they are on the border. And he explains, and what he puts into perspective for us is really to, in a sense, almost, we can feel Moshe Rabbeinu's, if you want to say, his whole perspective and how he was at that time, how he felt. So Moshe Rabbeinu is reaching the age of 120. He's nearly 120 years old. He knows he's going to pass away because Hashem told him, you're not going into the land. He knows that Yahushua is the one taking the Jewish people into the land. And as we've mentioned, Moshe is obviously devastated because he wanted to enter the land. This was his dream of his life, to enter the land of Israel. But besides for being devastated that he's not entering the land of Israel, there's another thing that bothers him. And I think we can all relate to that in our own way, is that Moshe led the Jewish people 40 years in the desert. He took them out of Egypt. He was there with them when they were leaving Egypt, but he didn't just take them. He put his whole life in danger to go to Paroi and to get them out of Egypt. So his whole entire, so to speak, if you want to say,
it's not career, his whole life, his whole everything was for the sake of the Jewish people and to get the Jewish people into the land of Israel and to complete the will of Hashem, of what Hashem wanted to accomplish in this world with the Jewish people. Now, what did Hashem want to accomplish? We all know when the Jewish people would be entering the land. Of course, the most important, the beautiful part was they would go into Israel and enjoy being there, being in Israel, of course, and the spiritual heights and whatever. There's no country like Israel. But there's much more than that. There were a lot of laws that they would have, that they would only be able to keep in the land. Not only that, but there's a lot of the parts of the process that would only be able to take place once they enter. So, for example, conquering the land, getting rid of all the enemies, that's a big one. Moshe was, as we say, the faithful shepherd. He had taken care of the Jewish people, provided them with all their needs, listened to all their complaints, calmed them down, beseeched on their behalf, ensured that they were actually still a nation entering the land, and now they're about to go in, conquer, and get rid of the enemies. And to Moshe, it's so frustrating that he has to remain on this side of the Jordan and is unable to accomplish that tremendous thing. Then after he knows what's going to happen after they get rid of all the enemies and conquer the land, then they're going to divide the land amongst the tribes. As we know, that's what they had to do. Give each tribe their portion. And actually, that's what's mentioned in this chapter. The next thing they would do after they did that was, as we said, was actually part of this is to, maybe it's before this even, is to define the borders, right? As we say. And Moshe so wanted to be the one to give the Jewish people, but not just to give them theoretically, but sort of to actually show them the borders of the land of Israel so that they know what they have, then to give them each their own portion, and then to do this mitzvah that we're talking about now of setting aside the cities of refuge, especially because Moshe had already began that mitzvah, because the three cities of refuge which were across the Jordan, he had already told them that they have to do that and that they were, you know, where they were. And then the last thing that we're going to discuss hopefully next week is the last thing in the parasha is the story of the Benos Tzlofchad. We've already had it, but it repeats it because here it's actually going to, you know, it's going to be really decided where the daughters of Tzlofchad also want a portion, right? So Moshe Rabbeinu is feeling so frustrated that he can't, so to speak, if you want to say, tie up all the loose ends. Why can't he complete his job, his mission in this world? I think we all feel that many times, that frustration, you know, when we start something, we want to finish it. You know, you start, I mean, it sounds silly, but like you start cooking and baking a dinner, you want to finish it. You start doing, anything you start doing, you want to finish. And in life, it's like that. You know, we educate children, we bring up, we want to finish what we've invested so much in. And as we know in life, it's not our choice and our decision of what happens to us and what we'll be able to actually finish and accomplish. But here we learn something so powerful. That Barbanel says a very fascinating theme. And he says like this, that Hashem said to Moshe Rabbeinu, you want to finish the job. But if you just take a step back and think about it for a moment, even if you would enter the land of Israel, and all these things that we just said, conquering, dividing, giving their portion, saying the borders, the Arei Miklat, would you be doing it yourself? Would you be the one, you on your own, doing all of those things? No. You would be guiding them. You would be informing them. You would be leading them. But the people would have to follow and implement. Everybody knows that whatever we do, we need help. We don't like to delegate. I mean, I don't, because I always feel like it never gets done properly. But that's the way the world works. We're only one person. We can't do the whole job ourselves. So what happens over here is something very fascinating. Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, even if you would have entered the land, all of these different, and he goes in detail about all these different things, you would have needed to have others help you do it. Therefore, Hashem says to Moshe, besides for the fact that we know that Hashem showed Moshe the land, you know, this beautiful thing that it says in Parshas Ve'eschanan, that Moshe Rabbeinu had this vision, but it says even more, the Medrash tells us it wasn't just like a vision, it was more like 3D, you know, like we can understand it now. You know, when you go on these kind of, what are they called, these rides where it's virtual. It's like a virtual thing. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu experienced at that time, where the land literally passed underneath him. And he actually had a spiritual so to speak, sense of being in the land. But besides for that, Hashem says to Moshe, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you these rules. You're going to give it over to the Jewish people. By doing that, you are playing a tremendous role, almost the same as if you would have gone in with them, because there you would have also have to delegate it. So this was such an incredible comfort, if you want to say, to Moshe Rabbeinu, to show him that his work was not incomplete. His work was complete. It's a fascinating thing for us to realize in life that many times we do have that sense of frustration. We should take a step back and say, no, maybe we shouldn't feel frustrated. It's Hashem running the world. As it's amazing, the Rabbeinu Bechai in his Shaar B'Tochen, he says beautifully, he says, you know, one of the big concepts of trusting in Hashem is to realize that we have to put in our effort, but at the end of the day, the success, so to speak, the actual getting the job done, that's up to God. He's the one who's going to make it happen. So we do our part, and then he does his part. What that means is that we should feel, when we do our part, that we, obviously, when the person puts in the right amount of effort and doing it right, we're not talking about doing it not correctly, but we're talking about when we do it properly, we actually have to feel a sense of accomplishment that we have done all that we can, and now it's truly up to Hashem. And yes, to feel, as we say in Pirkei Avos, Loi alecha hamlocha ligmar. It's not upon us to finish the job, but at the same time, Veloyata ben chayrin li batel mimena. We cannot be, so to speak, say, oh, I'm just not going to do it because I'm not going to be able to finish it. And this is a very powerful lesson for us. So on the both sides, on the one hand, not to feel despondent that we can't finish. On the other flip side, not to give up because we can't finish. Rather to keep on going and know that what we are doing is fulfilling our mission in its total, in its complete. So it's a very fascinating idea. What?
It's like a relay race.
A relay race. I love that. That's such a good analogy. It's a beautiful analogy. And in a way, a relay race is hard because if a person, it's a fascinating analogy, because if a person runs fast and the other, yeah, you don't get to cross the line unless you're the last one. And not only that, but sometimes you're doing it well, but the next person doesn't, and that frustrates you. So that's a very interesting thing. And that's what we learn here, as we can say, this is really the idea of B'tachon, because we do what we can, because this is our mission, and we believe that and trust that Hashem takes care of the rest, and giving it into the good hands. And this is what happened to Moshe Rabbeinu here. He was able to do that, and it's actually so powerful. I didn't read it inside. I always make the copies and don't read it inside. There might be one part that I want to see. Okay, let me just see. Yes, I'm going to see if there was anything that I want to see inside here. Okay, also, yeah, so it's. Oh, that's right. There was one more beautiful idea that comes in, and then I'll share with you why the Kohen Gadol dying. He says also something interesting. Another thing is that with the dividing of the land, not only the conquering, but the dividing, who was going to be the ones who are actually going to do it? It was going to be Yahushua, but the princes of each of the tribes were going to be the ones in charge to actually implement that division. And Moshe Rabbeinu was told something very powerful, and it was a beautiful thing. He told them, Moshe Rabbeinu was told that, let's say, for example, Elazar, the son of Aaron, he was going to be, all of the people who were being nominated now would not pass away for the next 14 years. They would complete the job. That's what he was told. So Moshe Rabbeinu knew that he was giving it over to the hands of people who would be able to actually implement it. Why is that significant? So first of all, it gives Moshe comfort. Second of all, it gives the Jewish people a tremendous sense of security. But third of all, we see something so incredible through this. What that means is, so Elazar, he becomes the Kohen Gadol. We said that when does the person leave the Arei Miklat, the city of refuge? When the Kohen Gadol dies. Moshe Rabbeinu separated the three cities of refuge across the Jordan, and then the Jewish people would separate them when they entered into the land proper. But we are told that the three cities of refuge across the Jordan, even though they were already there, do not take effect, do not provide refuge, are nothing until after the 14 years that the Jewish people conquer and settle and divide the land and separate the three in Eretz Yisrael proper. So the big question is why? Why do we have to wait for those three to be working, to be operating in order for these three to be operating if Moshe already designated them. So the comment is such a magnificent idea. I think it's the Meshech Chacham also says it's an extension here of the Abba Arbanel. Because if you see what the Abba Arbanel says here, what did Moshe Rabbeinu say? This Kohen Gadol, Elazar, he's not going to die until after the 14 years. It's such a powerful thing. When somebody is sentenced to this confinement, to this quarantine, where he has to be in this city, and he cannot leave this city, there has to always be, Torah wants, that a person should always live with a measure of hope. A person cannot be put into a situation where they are totally despondent, where there's no way out. That's why Hashem makes the world. We should never put ourselves in that, and we should realize that that never happens. Which means, if a person would have gone into the city of refuge, across the Jordan now, right, if it would take place immediately, then he would know for sure that for the next 14 years, he's stuck there. There's just no way possible that he's leaving before 14 years. And Hashem says that's not the way it works. I don't want a person to live without hope. I want them to always have the hope that any day now I can leave. And that's why it didn't take place until after the other ones were already set up and after it was time, when it was already time that this Kohen Gadol could pass away and then the next one would come into being and we have no idea how long he would live. That's one thing. But then we said one other thing. What is the idea of the Kohen Gadol dying? So I'll just show you. Okay, so it's, I didn't number the pages, but it's the third page, I think, from your thing. I want to show you something. If you see, it says on the top, Kuf Samach Dalet. I'll just show you something that's very nice here. I can scroll it down. See. Yeah, Kuf Samach Dalet. I'll just read it, I'll translate. He says, the person, V'amar Shiyashav Shom Ad Meis HaKohen Gadol, he's going to stay there until the Kohen Gadol dies. Lefisha HaKohen Gadol HaYasar V'Gadol B'Yisrael, because the Kohen Gadol was like one of the greatest leaders and one of the greatest spiritual presence amongst the Jewish people. The Kadosh LeElokav, he was holy to God. U'B'Maisai Kol HaAm Yecharad. And when he passed away, since he was such an incredible, great spiritual guide and leader, the entire nation would be actually shattered. They would feel a spiritual insecurity. That's what would happen, right? Because a spiritual gap, a spiritual lack, a spiritual insecurity. And they would be shaking. V'hachai yiten elibai. And we know that when, this is what's supposed to happen, but if somebody passes away, the people who are left behind take it to heart because they realize their immortality. And he says, ki imei ha'adam ketzel olam, right? That a person's life is not forever. V'lama lo yosir merayanav. So what will that do to the person? It will definitely, very strongly shake up the person that it will take away from him nikmas dam kreivai, any feelings of wanting to take revenge. Why would you want to take revenge when you start to realize what really matters in life and how life is temporary, how we all, nothing is permanent. And therefore you start to see and to realize real priorities, what really matters. And that's what it says over here. So he says, it will actually affect the person emotionally. The person will shift. That's what we're saying. So when this man leaves the city, the one who did the inadvertent murder, when he leaves the city of refuge, the family members have changed. It's amazing. When the Kohen Gadol passes away, the other family members have actually changed. Their emotional state changes because it affects them emotionally. And they reprioritize everything, and then he is takas safe. It's a quite a powerful idea. As he says, okay, there's another thing it says that the Kohen Gadol provides atonement for the Jewish people, and he should have asked for compassion for his generation. And obviously, he didn't daven enough, but that's a separate thing. That's why murder was able to happen. But it's quite an incredible, beautiful idea that it really affects us. And then, I just want to see something. And as we said before, and the Abba Arbanel ends, that Moshe Rabbeinu should, Hashem is trying to comfort, but it's not just an empty comfort. Really comfort Moshe and tell him, you have completed your job, you've done everything you've invested in, and you shouldn't feel in any way, shape, or form that there's something that you've left with a loose end. Because whatever you've done now, by especially instructing them properly, ensures that everything will get done. So that's a very powerful thing. Now, I think on your next page of your booklet, after all these, I think so, there is, I'll show you what I want you to see. This I want to do inside. Something really beautiful. There is this one that looks like this. Yeah, keep going. So it might be the fourth or the fifth page. Yeah, right after that page is... Yeah, that's it. That's right. Very good. So the next one is English. The first one is Hebrew. So it's actually a translation. And I'll do a little bit in the Hebrew, and then we'll go straight to the English after. And I'll show you something beautiful. This is something called Sefer HaChinuch. Sefer HaChinuch we've done in the past. He takes every single mitzvah, and he explains the rationale behind, like, so to speak, a little bit of the depth. But this is from his introduction. In the introduction to the Sefer HaChinuch, where he's going to enumerate all the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah, he tells us something very interesting. You know, we always talk about having 613 mitzvahs. Are we all obligated in 613 mitzvahs? Do we have?
Yeah.
No. Why not?
Superman.
Okay, that's the first, first difference. Wait, something happened. This computer died. Something, I don't know. Anyway, I don't know if people are still here. I don't know what happened. Should I see? Let me just see something. Sorry, I just want to check if this is still good. Oh, yeah, you're still here. Good. Sorry, it just did something funny. Okay. Some are for men, some are for women. What's another reason why we wouldn't have 613? Even less, you know, let's cut down more even. Exactly, Israel out of Israel, the time of the temple. The temple doesn't exist now, 100%. And then there are even certain mitzvahs that only happen in certain circumstances. So he gives an example. Let's say, for example, somebody, there's a mitzvah to do with paying wages on time. You know, when you hire somebody to work for you, you have to make sure to pay them on time. It's a fascinating thing. Some people might never hire anybody to work for them. It just might happen. So there are certain mitzvahs that we will never engage in because that will never come to us. So as we can see. So he gives a whole thing. He says, he actually goes through, he says, kol mitzvahs, all the mitzvahs, mitaryag mitzvahs from the 613 that are actually will be done now, he says, is vehein bein kulam shloish meyais v'shishim v'tisha. 369. So I guess those are the ones that we can do now because not all of us, but generally speaking, because it's not to do with the Beis Hamikdash, it's not to do with the land of Israel specifically. And he says, V'yesh me'elo ha'noyegas shelo yischayev ben adam ki im besiba, some of them, it only would happen because of a certain circumstance, and a person might not come to that circumstance. And then he goes, also things that we are like the negative commandments, also because a person puts themselves into a certain circumstance. In other words, it like says, for example, that if a person delays fulfilling a vow, so some of us might never make vows, right? So then we don't have that worry of delaying not fulfilling the vow, right? So these are all the different things. Then he says, now coming to the third paragraph, Aval oisa mitzvah shechayavim behem kol adam Yisrael, those mitzvahs which all Jewish people are obligated, mibli sheyischadesh b'yisiba ba'olam, hein ben kulam basayim v'shivim. The ones that, again, not enough, all of us actually, because some are men, but generally speaking that nowadays that we could come to doing that are more obligatory on everybody, which means, like, for example, what that means is like the mitzvah of Shabbos, keeping kosher. These are mitzvahs that it doesn't have to do with circumstance. We all have to keep Shabbos, right? Everybody's going to have to keep Shabbos. Everybody keeps kosher. We can't survive without eating, right? So he says, how many are there in total? 270. It's interesting how we've cut down from 613 to 270. And he gives a sign from a pasuk, Ani yishena, I sleep, v'libi er, and my heart is awake. Er is ayin resh, which is 270. And he says like this, there are 48 positive commandments and 222 negative. V'timtza kol achas b'seder shaloi b'secha sefer v'yesh alem. Okay, so he says, v'achiv shaloisan la'seisan. And we know that the obligation of these 270 are not b'chol eis. They're not all the time. Rak b'zmanim yiduim min hashana, only at certain times of the year or certain times of the day. Except, and here we're going to see something very interesting, there is a concept that there is chutz mishisha mitzvahs Shehein Chiyuv and Tmidi. These are called the six constant mitzvahs. This is a fascinating thing, that there are six mitzvahs that we are obligated, everybody, man, woman, 365 days a year, day and night, all the time. From when we turn bar and bat mitzvah, this is our obligation. What are the six mitzvahs that we have constantly upon us is fascinating. It's actually important to know. We would think these mitzvahs should be learned very deeply, because this is something which we're all obligated constantly. You can, if you want, go to the next page, because I'll just show you them in English. It's important to see them. It says, Lahamin Bahashem, which means, if you see on the bottom of the next page, to believe in the eternal Lord. Okay, to believe in Hashem, that's a constant mitzvah. Interesting. Then, not to believe, as we say, in any other god. Okay, interesting. That's also a constant mitzvah. Liyachadai, to have faith that he is one. This is an interesting thing, and I'll come back to that in 1 second. To love him is the next one. To fear him, as we say, to have awe. And the last one is, fascinating, not to go astray following after the thought of the heart or the sight of the eyes. That we say in Shema, right? Not to let our, in other words, not to let our Yetzirah, the evil inclination, convince us of what's the right way when it's the wrong way, right? So not to follow that. Okay, interesting.
That's almost the first commandment.
In which way do you...
Because they're all about our relationship to Hashem.
Yeah.
To believe in him, not believe in any other God.
Yeah. So it comes from Anoichi and Lo Yelecha, exactly. Mm-hmm. They're really both in the first two, 100%. Mm-hmm. 100%. And there are many commentaries who discuss how you derive all of them from that. This interesting one that we said, to have faith that he is one, what does that mean? When we're talking about faith that he is one, we're talking about the fact that God alone runs the world. There isn't any other true existence besides God. This is something that we truly believe in, and he's the one, obviously, as we say, should he not bring the world into existence at every moment, we would cease to exist. So this actually plays into the whole idea of this trusting in him and knowing that he is actually part of our moment-to-moment, day-to-day life. It's more than when we talk about believing in Hashem, that's emunah. That's a little bit more in the mind and a little bit more distant, whereas this one is more of the fact that Hashem is literally one and part of our life. There is no other existence, nothing else that exists in a sense, if not for Hashem's willing it to exist at that moment. Okay, now why did I mention this? Where does this come in here? So the last line, oh, it doesn't have it on the English, does it? Ah, yeah, look, I'll show you the last word it says there on the bottom. It says, a mnemonic for them is, there shall be, for you, six cities of refuge. Very interesting. He brings this pasuk, and this is a concept that we're talking about now, the cities of refuge, right? These are a miklat. The six cities of refuge, so there's six constant mitzvahs. What's the connection? What does one have to do with another? So we say a very beautiful thing. It's explained that the concept is that Hashem has given us a very interesting, a magnificent gift, actually, when he gave us the Torah. And we say like this, that when a person, a fascinating thing, when a person does something against the Torah, does a, you know, we say, commits a sin, you want to say, so... A very interesting thing. It says that most people, most of the time, we don't go against the Torah willingly. Even though some people will say they do, but they don't. The reason that we say it's not willingly is because if a person would be aware of what happens when they commit a sin, they wouldn't do it. What happens when a person commits a sin? When they go against the will of Hashem, that's what a sin is. In other words, doing something which Hashem said specifically not to do, or not doing something that he wants you to do, which means going against his will. You are actually severing or breaking or weakening, at least, your connection with Hashem. Now, if you think about it, what does that mean when you're saying you're weakening your connection? We all know that our whole life force comes from Hashem. So the example that we could give is, it would be like if somebody had oxygen that they were breathing in and they were underwater, and you would be squeezing the tube and letting a lot less oxygen in. Well, that's going to make it very hard for you to breathe. Nobody in their right mind is going to do that. What people will do is open as many openings to have as much oxygen coming. In other words, to have as much energy and as much life force as possible. So if a person was aware that every time they do a mitzvah, they are providing more life energy. And every time they don't do a mitzvah, so to speak, or they transgress, they're actually cutting off some of their life energy. Well, they wouldn't engage in it. So we are all inadvertent sinners in that way. And it's also like murder, and it's a strong language, but the idea is that we are taking away life force. That's what we're doing. We're disconnecting from our source of life. So therefore, the Sefer HaChinuch tells us something very powerful. What Hashem does is, he says, he knows human beings. We all have failings. And we're going to, for a moment, you know, our mind is going to not be focused. And we're going to make mistakes. And we're going to do things wrong. Not intentional, because of Yetzirah, because it's all enticing, whatever it is. Because that's the way it is. It's more comfortable, it's easier, whatever it may be. So Hashem says, don't worry. Don't get despondent. Don't become like that. It's finished. There's no chance. He says, I provide for you 6 cities of refuge. These are the constant mitzvahs that a person should be constantly engaging in. Now, obviously, a person might not be engaging in them. But what it means is that they're always there for us to refuel our energy. So even at a moment, if you've caught yourself, I did something wrong, and now I've cut off some of my energy, you should know that even though, let's say, it was Shabbos, and I did something wrong on Shabbos, now it's Sunday. Well, it's Sunday, I can't keep Shabbos. That's true. But you know what you could do on Sunday? All these 6 mitzvahs. Because any time of the day, you can do all these 6 mitzvahs, and any day of the week. Therefore, we can always restore our connection to Hashem by working on these mitzvahs, by believing in Him, trusting in Him, loving Him, fearing Him. All these mitzvahs are there to constantly restore our connection to Hashem. And that's why they are like the 6 cities of refuge, which is a very beautiful idea. And obviously it brings us to a very fascinating thing, that these mitzvahs are really something that sometimes are a little bit overlooked, because they're more in our mind and in our heart, rather than practical, able to do something, right? So therefore, it can happen, where a person can go through, let's say, keep a beautiful Shabbos, let's say, for example, right? Do everything 100%, you know, and have a magnificent, inspirational Shabbos. And yet, at the same time, be forgetting who gave us the Shabbos, right? The Shabbos is not only about feeling rested, it's also about the belief in Hashem, that He created the world. So that's why we have to constantly refocus and remember the source of everything. So that's one very beautiful lesson. Then there's another fascinating lesson from this whole idea that we're talking about here, about, as we mentioned before with the Kohen Gadol, that the Kohen Gadol dying is when the person goes out of the city of refuge, right? That's when he's able to, so to speak, leave the city of refuge. So what does that have to do with anything? So we say a very fascinating thing. We say that when this person is there, why is he in there? Why is he in the city of refuge? Because he has committed even an inadvertent murder. But as we know in society, if you look at the rungs of, you know, who's the top, who's the bottom, who's the middle, the murderers are the lowest rung. I mean, nobody wants to be with a murderer. A murderer is the lowest thing you can do. Taking away somebody else's life is the lowest thing a person can engage in. Who's from the highest member of society? The Kohen Gadol. He's the most spiritual person that ever lived. He goes, he has, you know, one with Hashem in the Holy of Holies. And we see something very, very powerful. We see that for ourselves, it's an amazing lesson, that even though we all try to lead our life in the right way, we try to do the best thing possible. And then we know people who are living lives on a much different world, if you want to say. They engage in things they shouldn't be engaged in. Their life, unfortunately, is quite low. You might feel that you have no connection to them. You're living your life on the moral high ground, and they're doing everything that's wrong. So the Torah here teaches us something so powerful. He says to us, as a Jew, we should know that we are so connected to every other Jew, it doesn't matter how low they've sunk. Even the murderer is connected to the Kohen Gadol and is dependent on him. And the Kohen Gadol is dependent on the murderer, because obviously he doesn't want the person to be davening that he dies. So there's this incredible connection that we have no matter what we engage in. So this is another very powerful thing from the idea of waiting, if you want to say, for the Kohen Gadol to die. Now I want to go into one other beautiful thing. If you go now, I think it's in that order, up on the, after the, turn the page,
I know this is in Yiddish. I'm going to read you one paragraph inside. I know I shouldn't have made... I always feel a bit bad that I make these copies and then I don't use them because I never know. But anyways, this is a beautiful, beautiful talk from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And he goes actually quite simply into this whole idea of the Arei Miklat and what that means for us in our life. Because as we said, it's all very nice and good to separate these cities that we're talking about, six cities of refuge. We have nothing to do with it. It doesn't apply in our time. We can't do it. We don't have the Holy Temple. We don't own the entire land of Israel. We cannot do this. And thank God, I mean, we have a whole different system now. And it's just an interesting thing. What does that have to do with me and you? Okay, so one thing we said, it represents the six constant mitzvahs. That's true. So that's one way. But there's even more than that. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe goes to a very beautiful thing, and he says that the truth is that the six cities of refuge obviously are physical cities, providing physical refuge for people who did a physical murder. And yet, where do they come from? What's the evolution in Torah? They have a spiritual counterpart. Everything in the physical realm has a spiritual counterpart. How, as people, very interesting, it brings a very beautiful idea that as people, because we live in this physical world, this is our reality, how do we even know anything about the spiritual reality? We derive it from the physical, right? So we say, like for example, as we say over here, since there are six cities of refuge, so there must be a six something or some kind of idea, never mind six, but some kind of idea of six, of cities, of refuge, some kind of concept in the spiritual. The truth is that what comes first, the spiritual comes first, right? That's really, the physical is derived from the spiritual. But for us, we could see it only the other way around. And he brings a very fascinating story of one of the Chabad Rebbes that it was the time, I should see in the years, but let's say it was like in the 1920s or something, and there was a new scientific, I don't know if you want to say, discovery about a vein in the brain of a person, that it says that this vein is what controls memory and also it controls the memory and also controls a person's focus when a person tries to concentrate deeply on something. And depending on how you move your head will be what you're using. In other words, he said like this, that when, if we think about it, when a person wants to remember something, what do they do? A lot of times you go like this, and you're trying to remember, you pick up your head. When you're concentrating on something, you put your head down to concentrate, right? Because, and they said it's because it has to do with some kind of vein in the brain, that depending on which position it's in, it helps with this and that. Okay, it's very nice. And they were talking about it at the table, and the Rebbe at the time, the Rebbe Rashabs, he didn't say anything at the moment, but then he went out and he took out a book of Chassidus, which was written 50, 60 years before that. And there it mentions this vein. And it says the same idea. So this other person says, oh my gosh, that means that this Rebbe that wrote it was a scientist. He says, no, he wasn't a scientist. And he didn't even know the science. But he knew it from the holy spheres, from the original, so to speak. In other words, in the counterpart, in the spiritual worlds. That's how it works. And because it works that way spiritually, it evolves into the physical that way. If we were lucky, we would be able to understand things that way, but we don't. But at least what we have to do is look at the physical and derive, therefore, what is the lesson in the spiritual. So what does that have to do with us? So we'll see, let's understand, what does this concept of a city of refuge mean? So if you think about it just practically, as we said, the city of refuge provides refuge for somebody who has committed a murder. And as we said, every time we do something wrong, we are cutting off our life force, so we are like inadvertent murderers. What happens? A person might become despondent, especially after many wrongdoings accumulate, and a person might think hopeless. So Torah says, it's never hopeless. I am providing for you places of refuge. In Torah, there is always places, and we know, we have every week, we have Shabbos, we have even the morning that we daven, we have the month of Elul. The month of Elul is considered the big time of refuge for the whole year. Every Jew should know that there's always an opportunity to find a safe space to recharge, and yes, you will be able to then exit and be stronger. But we learned something amazing from, as we learned last week in the Rambam, 2 weeks ago, whenever it was.
to go on the, you remember these cities of refuge, obviously if there's only three of them on the main part of Eretz Yisrael, how would a person know where to go? So we said that the roads have to be wide and there has to be very clear signs that tells you where to go. And not only that, but it's interesting, according to some opinions, there were signs that would say, you know, this is the direction. And then there would also be sometimes people who would guide along the way and say, miklat, miklat, you know, this is the way to the refuge. So we see something very, very amazing. That as a human being, as a person, we have a responsibility, we know, to ourselves, but to everybody. As a Jew, we know that we know that for sure now, whether we like it or not. We're each one, the truth is we do feel that. So what happens? A person should realize that when they are, in a sense, feeling secure, what they must make sure is to be providing the signage, the guidance, the, so to speak, if you want to say, the map, the where to go for the people who are looking for the refuge. This is all of our responsibility. And this, he says, this is a very fascinating thing. So we have to know that there is a city of refuge, and we have to provide and make sure to ensure that the way to the city of refuge is clear to everybody. So that any time a person, God forbid, feels like they're falling, they should know where they can go to rebuild, to refocus, and to be able to redirect their life. This is our responsibility. And he says a very interesting thing. Sometimes a person, and he says, we see it now, it's unbelievable. I think in Israel you see, everybody, but most people have a certain sense of responsibility, and everybody's doing it in their own way. Whatever they can do, you know, you see all these videos, it's incredible. People providing food, people providing every kind of assistance that you can possibly think of. And everybody does what they could in their own unique way, right? So we have an interesting thing that sometimes in life we try, we have the good intention. So we'll go out, so to speak, we'll go out of our comfort zone and we'll try to help somebody else find, you know, so to speak, the place of refuge. And yet sometimes we can do certain work and we don't see results, right? Not only don't we see results, but sometimes we can feel like we're screaming, you know, like we're standing on the way and nobody's passing by. Nobody needs us, you know? We'll be screaming, refuge, refuge, it's this direction. Nobody's listening to us, nobody's looking at us, nobody needs us, we're not accomplishing anything, and it can become quite difficult. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe says a beautiful thing. He says, a person, first of all, we must always do it, no matter what. That we can never shirk our responsibility. And we should know that even after a full day of us putting, investing effort and thinking and trying to help, and nobody's taking our advice or nobody needs us or nobody, and we can go home and think we've done nothing, we have no idea what we've done. And he gives a very beautiful example. And this was a real thing that happened. It was, you know, in the early days when the Lubavitcher Rebbe was very much promoting that people should do the miftzoyim, like, let's say, for example, going out to teaching people about Yiddishkeit. So there was a bacher who went out and he wanted to put on tefillin with other men, and he spent a whole day and not one person agreed to put on tefillin. And he came home and it was a whole day he was standing there, whatever it was, in the heat, and he felt so despondent. He didn't learn himself. He didn't do anything like for himself. He didn't grow spiritually, and he didn't even help anybody else. So he rode in and he was like, well, and the Rebbe says something interesting. What he wasn't aware was that there was a person looking from the window and saw him there. This person was a person whose grandfather had been a religious Jew. And when he saw this bacher with his beard and his tefillin and whatever, he didn't go out to put on tefillin. No, he wasn't so motivated at that moment. But it started him thinking. And then the next day, he started to feel a little bit of maybe enough guilt or a motivation. And he did one mitzvah. Now, this kid doesn't know that he caused somebody else because he has no idea. But a person should never undervalue what they do, because we don't know the effect or what we have on another person. What would be an example for us is, we know a lot of, it's interesting, sometimes we have this, we'll go about our day, we'll decide, you know, we'll do the right thing, you know, we'll talk nicely, we'll smile, and all the things that we get in response are all the negative things. And we might think we are accomplishing nothing, we're hitting our head against a brick wall. We have no idea of how much we are accomplishing, and we might never know. But Hashem knows. And we should never, ever underestimate and undervalue it. And he brings another very beautiful, find a fascinating story, because we're talking really, Arei Miklat, what's really the Miklat, what's the refuge, is really the learning of Torah. Because when a person learns, they fill their mind with inspiration, with godly wisdom, and that definitely elevates and changes the way they see everything throughout the day. But there are some people who are resistant to learning Torah. They're not interested. So you might think, well, how am I going to help? How am I going to share? They're not interested. So you do what you can. So he brings a cute example that there was once where he was giving a talk, the Lubavitch Rebbe, and a conservative rabbi came out of interest. I don't know. He came to the talk. And nothing, he didn't change, you know, he wasn't going to change anything the way he was acting. He just came. So he came and he enjoyed the talk. And then he had Hebrew school. And in America, it's a big thing, you know, the Hebrew school. And he was telling the children about the fact that, you know, that there are Jews. And he started to describe them, you know, the way he described a religious Jew, you know, all the different way they look. And never mind religious, but Hasidic. And, you know, they wear these special kind of hats and they have beards. And I mean, this was in the 1960s. And these kids were looking at him and they said, when was this? 200 years ago? It can't be. Anyways, he couldn't convince them that it actually was real. So he decided the only way he finally figured out, he said, you know what, I'll ask one of them to come into school and maybe they'll see that there's really people who look like that. So he asked, and of course the person was willing. They came in and the children saw, and they, you know, they just spoke to him, nothing, you know, no, nothing earth-shattering. They just saw that this is real, that people really do live this way. But this person would have didn't know any effect from it, and nothing changed. But what happened was, we don't know again, we can just imagine, the child goes home and tells his parent what happened today in Hebrew school and what he saw, and the effect is subtle, and we don't know. We don't know what happens from one small thing to another. The idea is, this concept of Arei Miklat, of providing refuge, is something which is an obligation even today. We have to ensure that there are places of refuge, that there are places of sense of, if you want to say, of well-being, of security, of connection for everybody. And not only that, but we have to provide that we make sure that people know where they are and how to get there. And when we do it, we shouldn't ever feel like we've not accomplished, because we don't know. And a lot of it is just by living by example, as we say. You live by the right example. You live by the moral and ethical way that you represent as a Jew, and you have no idea the effect that you have. But even more, obviously, it's sometimes we live by example, but sometimes we can actually accomplish where we can actually directly talk to somebody, as we say. We can be either a sign that's just like standing there dormant, or we can be a sign that's a talking sign, like we have nowadays, and actually guiding people, whichever way, everybody in their own way, in their own time in life, in their own circumstances, whatever it may be. But we know we can share that Torah is the most incredible refuge, the most incredible protection, and the most incredible, if you want to sense of purpose and meaning. And I just was thinking yesterday, so amazing, in all these videos, I mean, it's so scary, but you see all these videos going around about, like Friday night, right, there was a lot of sirens, and people were in these, some people were like in the car parks underneath their building, because as you say, there's not place even in those safe rooms. And what was beautiful, a few of them were going around, I mean, these are mixed communities, so religious, not religious, all ages, every kind of person was there. And what was beautiful, they were singing, a lot of them, singing together, everybody joining in. And it was just so magnificent to see. I just felt like when we have, and it's such a time of danger, such a time of unsettledness, and we don't even have an end date. It's not like they're saying it's going to finish tomorrow. You know, they're trying to tell them it's going to take a little bit of time. And yet that sense of, because we live with such a sense of purpose, such a sense of meaning, it gives us, it's just such a strength that it gives us. That's why I was thinking that the aimlessness of, I feel my heart breaks for the, and I'm not saying in a judgmental way, but in the West, I mean, when you talk about here in Australia and in America, a lot of the youth just aimless. They have no purpose. They have nothing that they're living for, no greater good that they're living for. And you see how it just self-destructs. And on the flip side, when a person has meaning and purpose, even in the most difficult times, you're just feeling so uplifted. So Hashem should help that we should all feel that, but we shouldn't need to, you know, as we say, we should live without the need of the refuge, if you want to say, but with meaning and purpose, in a sense, with joy, and things should resolve very, very quickly in Mirtz Hashem that we should be able to live peacefully in Eretz Yisrael. And of course, with Mashiach, that would be the ideal. And then we'll have again. And that's one thing we didn't explain, why we need Arei Miklat when Mashiach will come. Maybe next week quickly. And we'll go to the last topic, which is the topic of the Benos Slavchad.